something went on here, something went on there. And
this time on TNT,
we talk about Alanis, Arden, and Avril.
And tick, 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 tick. What's that? It's Jet's cowboy boots pounding down the street.
And we talk about all the other great music from 1995. That's all coming up right now on TNT.
Hey.
Hey.
Jonathan.
Yeah?
I got something for you. You want to play a game? It's called What Were You Doing?
Okay.
And I'm going to play a song and you tell me what you were doing when you first heard it, okay?
Oh, good. Okay.
Ready?
Yep.
Okay. Because it's... What were you doing? See if you can...
Seal, Kiss from a Rose.
Yeah. So what were you doing?
I was at J.J. Rossi's in Halifax, where they had 99-cent drink specials. The third floor is where, like, the athletes from St. Mary's University hung out. There's a little dance floor up there. It's kind of a scene. There was a lot of carpet in there, as I recall, that your feet would stick to because of draft foam and barf. It was down in the historic properties in Halifax. And you're probably hoping to slow dance with a special someone when you heard this song, weren't you?
Well, it's 95. These are all 95 jams.
Someone told... Where did I read recently that Kiss from a Rose was about cocaine?
Whoa, really?
Yeah.
Scoops? Seal was Berlin on the Scoops?
Scoops and Doozies.
Really? Get out of here. Really? I never heard that. Come on.
What does it mean? Story? Kiss from a Rose.
You're hanging out with Seal and he's just ripping in the can to do rails?
That's what the people think it's about.
He was like... The Weekend back in 95 styles?
Where was the first time you ever heard it?
This song, Kiss from a Rose, I was already on tour and I think it was on Columbia because I remember hearing it as like a co-label thing. So I remember hearing it and it was a worldwide smash. So I just remember it being everywhere. And 95... I think I probably first heard that when I was, I don't know, probably opening for Van Halen that summer.
I think
it was out in the summer.
The Batman Forever soundtrack. Seal didn't like it. Many fans have pondered whether it's about drug use, while others say it's an expression of love or even a journey to the afterlife. Seal has never fully explained what the song is actually about, only saying that there was some kind of relationship that inspired the lyrics. He was embarrassed by it at first.
Wow.
Yeah.
Just ripping into it. I love it. I'd like the breakdowns.
I know. Seal's like, I don't know. I didn't really like it.
So he never said anything anyway. It's just everybody else. It was huge, that song. Like, that song, it's still paying him big time, I bet.
Well, he said it took me from being a nobody to it sold 8 million copies or something.
Yeah.
To be honest, yeah. I was never really that proud of it.
It's a pretty
tape in the corner, and then the producer turned that tape from my corner into another 8 million record sales, and my name became a household name, but he was embarrassed by it.
Like, if you listen to that jam sonically, it's pretty insane. It's large.
What does that mean?
Well, it's just huge. It's a hit for one thing. It's like you hear it right away. There's a vibe. He sings amazingly. And it's just super powerful and passionate, right? So it's the theme is very universal, right? You want to play that for your significant other to get things going on a Saturday night.
So what do you mean the meaning everywhere. Is universal?
Well, the concept is like whatever. It's kind of feels romantic or whatever. So I'm saying that's going to bang all over the place. Everyone's going to want to hear that. Just conceptually as a song, lyrics, melody, jam, it's all bulletproof, right? It's just coming out blazing. I bet you he knew it was a strong song. Like he just probably... Maybe he thought other songs that he'd written had were better for different reasons, but the pop, the hit songs are about simplicity, and the simpler the better. If you can do that in a unique way, then that's why that song was so big.
Here's the moment in that song that is surprising. You know, it goes, there's so much I need to tell you, so much I can say. That's pretty normal. But then that, you remain. What an unexpected choice that is.
Yeah, he's crushing it. He's taking the back half of the beat and turning it around just to get into things.
Have you ever slow danced to that song?
Probably. Banged up.
The notion of you slow dancing on a dance floor anywhere to that song brings me great joy.
Is it as good as Jet at the Black by Pearl Jam? The do 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 do. Remember that one? Him in cowboy boots at the place Brunny? Where always people, the Brunswick House in Toronto, on stage, all hammered.
Was he slow dancing with someone or slow dancing with himself?
Yeah. Fuck it. I'm getting up on stage. I don't care. I love this jam. Because he was just ripped. Oh my gosh.
Okay, you ready for your first 95er?
That was when he was running away from the crazy guy outside in the cowboy boots.
And the guy chased him.
We just heard Jet like tick, 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 tick. His boots just going so fast.
Were you standing watching or were you running?
We ran away from this crazy guy who knew karate. Jet knocked down the sign out front of this like shawarma place or something, and the cook guy came out and started doing like bends and stretches like he was about to get into a fight, so we all ran away. Yeah, we all booked away, and then I just saw Jet across the street when I was like hiding in an alley, just tick, 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 his boots just ripping by.
What time of year was it? Like icy sidewalk?
It was like, nighttime, probably late fall, chilly, but not too chilly. Jet was rocking the cowboy boots. Jet was rocking the cowboy boots to maximize his chance with the ladies.
Why, because cowboy boots were having a moment?
I don't know. Him and Elliot were like, come on, let's put on the boots. Like, it was a move, like, was going to work.
Tick, 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 tick. So where did he catch his breath? Like, several blocks away?
Oh, yeah, everybody got away. I'm sure the cook guy was like, all right, that's enough. But that cook guy was going to kick our asses big time.
Have you ever, like, stopped?
Little short guy, but, like, super stocky. And he started doing these, like, those moves where you stick your leg straight up in the air.
Oh, yeah, you guys didn't stand a chance. Did this guy work at the Brunny?
No, it was, like, the next block on Bloor Street.
Oh, you stopped to grab a shawarma on the way home.
Jet just like knocked over the sign because he was banged up and thought it was funny. And they're like, what do you do that for? He's like, oh, whatever, pick it up. And then the guys start stretching.
Imagine how many idiots that guy's had to deal with over the years.
Well, I mean, that opening move is the way he was doing it. Like, I've seen guys pretend that they know what they're doing, but this guy was doing stretches that you have to really practice to get going, so I'm not gonna.
He was doing the Krav Maga warm up.
Well, he was doing those ones where you get down and you're like on a squat, but then like one leg would go way over, and then he would do like he'd stand up and then one leg went like parallel with his like whole body.
He was swarming up to take Jet down. Because Jet's not a small lad, well, is he?
No, it was Elliot, too. It was Jet, Elliot, and me. I think Damien, our cousin, was there, too, yeah. But we all ran away.
Man.
But, yeah, crazy. So,
Have you ever been involved in something that escalated and became a bar fight and you were in it?
Yeah.
You have?
I was like the guy ducking punches and just kind of staying out of it, but like staying there.
But did your mouth
I've done that a couple times. Never, not really, no, no. No, hell no. Especially in those old days. But, like, I remember one time on the street, there was, like, three guys, and, you know, something happened where Jet and Elliot were chirping and back and forth, and I was like, this is going to be a fight. But then the one guy, and this was probably around that same year, I was just a skinny guy with thick glasses and short hair. And the guy's like, whatever, man, just get that, make sure that guy stays away from me. And I was just trying to stop the fight. But the guy was like, whatever, man, just keep that guy away from me. Like, I was like the big threat.
Whoa.
Dude, I was just trying to kind of stop it. But it was, that's me in fights, is more like trying to avoid getting hit.
Yeah, but same.
And when I was like partying and drinking all the time, I never got into fights like that. That's just stupid. That's how you die.
I never understood why that would be your instinct when you're banged up. Like, I'm having a good time. I want to punch some people in the face.
For the record, I was always completely, like, I had never drank anything until I was 28, right? So I was always the sober guy of the group. But, you know how kids are. Especially out east in PEI, when some guys just think fighting's part of the deal. And it's fun.
What happened at 28 that you were like, you know what? I'm going to have a drink.
Boredom, like, on 28? The road. Why 28? Boredom. Like, 12 hours of doing nothing was just too much. I couldn't do it anymore without, like, trying something. So, yeah.
Do you remember, someone like, have a drink, Jared, it'll be fun?
I think I was with Mike Eisenstein on the bus.
Who's that?
I had a great time. Michael Eisenstein played in Letters to Cleo, and he's got his own thing going in LA as a session musician and his own bands. He's a great dude. And yeah, I just joined him one night and got banged up and had some laughs, and that was it. The next night I probably started again, and the next didn't stop for 6 months or whatever. Took a day off.
Really?
And went again. Yeah, I jumped head first, and probably just, like I said, I was just kind of bored and not really, I had just too much time on my hands. That's the worst thing in the world. You know?
Yeah.
When you're just sitting around and you're like trying to get a day to finish and there's nothing you can do. Like, you can only see a new town so many times at that point where you're like, especially when you're working, you know how it is when you're out on the road all the time and you're in St. Louis and you've seen the Arch 30 times. So you just sit in your hotel room.
Never seen the Arch banged up.
Yeah, exactly.
Gives you a whole new lease on life.
So anyway, we should get to your first one of the 95.
Hey, Jer.
What are you doing? Yeah.
What were you doing? Remember?
It's hard to hear. Is that Shaggy?
Yes. Bombastic. They call me Mr. Bombastic. Goomba fantastic. Goomba gabba lava. Gotta woo.
I couldn't hear it, but then I heard him doing this Shagadelic.
You heard him purring like a kitten.
That, again, probably roaming around, learning depending on that year, summertime would have been that Van Halen tour. Fall, we were actually on tour for our big Canadian first tour with Tripping Daisy, and Blind Melon was supposed to be on it, but Shannon Hoon died like 2 weeks before it started.
No way.
Yeah. So right around that time.
Did you ever meet the Shannon Hoon?
No, we were supposed to do that tour together.
Dang.
And we're looking, we were both looking forward to it, had posters printed up and everything, and it was literally a couple weeks from the shows. It had been announced and sold out. And so yeah, it was pretty, it was a bummer. We opened for Blind Melon at Lee's Palace, like a year earlier.
Oh, you did? So you had met him before?
I don't think I met Shannon, but I know I talked to the rest of the guys at like soundcheck, because I don't remember what happened, but I had no backup sticks, so the drummer was nice enough to hook me up with a set of sticks.
A code among drummers. Let's play VTube for a second. I'll give you 5 million more or less views than Shaggy Boombastic. How many views do you think that has?
Oh, man, that's probably...
5 million either side, you get it.
It's got to have 12 million.
125 million.
Holy shit.
749,338 views.
I just saw Clumsy got past the 4 million mark. So I was thinking like, well, okay, that's a big deal. And then 172 million, like, forget about it. That ain't nothing.
Has the 4 million what?
Views on YouTube.
Really?
Yeah.
What does that mean? That's
just
people listening
that song.
To the whole record?
That no, that song has that many views on YouTube.
Wow.
But I'm saying, imagine 172, what's Kiss from a Rose? I bet you that's like frickin' a billion.
Stand by,
Gangnam,
please.
Gangnam Styles.
Stand by, please.
It's gotta
that
be.
That is Gangnam Styles.
It's gotta be over 500 milli.
Official
guaranteed.
Music video, 720. Okay, guess. VTube, guess how many?
I'll underestimate, say 712 million.
39 million.
What? No way.
Yeah.
What? My mind has been blown. Shaggy just crushed them.
I know. That's why Shaggy's doing records with Sting.
Yeah, no kidding.
Because Shaggy
like people
probably
say
has more
like,
views than Sting.
There's like those sneaky artists that like you don't really hear much of, and then wait a second, they're everywhere, like that Sean Paul dude, right? Like it's like I don't know his own song, I just know I hear his voice all the time, right? That guy's probably got like 500 hits or something. Or Pitbull.
If you do a
or...
feature on someone's record and you're a Shaggy, what do you get paid for that?
Oh man, it's a lot. It could be like, I mean, I remember back in the early 2000s hearing like Bob Rock was doing some songs with Swiss Beats, like Metallica and Swiss Beats did a song for something, and
yeah,
like that guy would like back then would give like a feature, like I don't know, they probably give him 200 grand or something, but they would give him like a Rolex when they got there. So I don't know, maybe that was how they did that, like maybe it was like a $40,000 watch or something, just to kind of spit a few bars.
Wow.
But, I mean, now you get guys that are like making $1 million just to do two, 16 and just
I know, but
split.
If you're trying to, if you have the dough and you're trying to buy your way onto the charts, right?
Yeah. No, I know. It's really
money well
it's,
spent.
It's big time hustling, man, because like you have guys out there that have just so much liquid cash. They just buy the features like no, it's nothing.
Liquid
you
cash
have to,
cane.
You just have to. You also have to have your ear together, and but it makes sense that you see a lot of hip hop artists that kind of just come from you think is nowhere, and then they just blew up on SoundCloud, and now they're printing cash, and they're rich as all, and they're just doing that same thing, just jumping from feature to feature, and. It's a lot of money to be made. Like what our boy down there in Murder on the Beat, living down there near Tim Oxford. Like that guy's making some serious cash. Yeah, it's crazy.
You know, I get asked all the time to do J-Rock features on people's records.
Yeah,
should
right?
I start doing them?
Murder Beats should do a J-Rock jam.
Yeah.
You should hit it up.
I'm going to start doing J-Rock features for $350.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. Just crushing it. I'll stick okay, is 16 it my, on your record for $350. Yes, it's your turn.
Is it my turn? Yes, it is, right?
Yes.
Okay, let's do it here. Here we go. Here comes. Hey, Jonathan.
Yeah?
What were you doing? The Crossroads, bud. Remember Bone Thugs?
Wow. I'm gonna say I'm driving in my Jeep Cherokee. My first car ever.
Yeah.
It was red and had red rust on it too, and it had a miss where every time I stopped at a red light or at a stop sign, it would stall.
Yeah.
So I only turned right because I could turn right on a red and just kind of coast instead of coming to a complete stop. I won have a cell phone in your car package, and I had a cell phone in my car in 1995 until it was stolen out of my car. So I was probably driving around in my first car listening to C100, Breakfast Club, and they were probably playing that jam.
Bone Thugs.
Driving around Halifax.
Just
crushing
it.
This is before I learned to drive a standard, and Halifax and San Francisco are probably the two most cruel cities to learn to drive a standard in because they're so hilly. Imagine
this is,
some of those like Halifax Hills by Citadel Hill. You're at a red light in a standard that you're learning to drive at a 45 degree angle. What do you mean?
The Crossroads, bud. That was Eazy-E, remember? He was in that band, Bone Thugs.
Whoa.
And then he died, and I think that's that jam, right? But here's my Bone Thugs story. Is our first American label was Relativity Records, which was Bone Thugs, was the other artist. It was like,
so did you ever meet the Mavs?
It was a hip-hop label. No, but we met all the Mavs that worked that record. And obviously with Eazy-E, I think Eazy-E had was on there too, Relativity. But yeah, good times in 95. What were you going to say
crazy.
There?
I don't remember. I was going to play your jam.
Okay.
Okay, see if you can hear this one. Michelle Pfeiffer is in the video.
Oh, it's Coolio, Gangsta's Paradise.
Yes.
When he sits down and he's doing the big, you're going to get it, the big interrogation.
Yes, you remember that. We have to get to the chorus because it was such a bop. That's what the kids say now.
Yeah, man, it's a Stevie Wonder jam,
flow,
right?
Didn't he?
He did. Coolio was great. Yeah.
What do you mean it's here comes. Yes. She was a teacher with a heart of gold. Just trying to connect, you know? That's all. She's just trying to connect, you know? That's all.
It's the jam. I remember that song,
Stevie Wonder jam?
It's, what the hell? It was called, is it Pastime Paradise?
I didn't even know
that's
that.
That's the original version? I think it's, Songs in the Key of Life record, which is like incredible.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah, man. It's a Stevie Wonder jam. That's why it's so tight.
It is tight. Hit me with your next one.
Okay, your next one is here it comes, bud. Hey, Jonathan.
Yeah?
What What were you doing when you heard this one?
Aww.
You always know, dude.
I guess it's time.
Is this Robbie Williams singing?
Was Take That? Is that what they were called?
Yeah. But wasn't he in Take That? Is that him singing this?
Must be.
What were you doing, bud?
Aww.
Oh,
probably
what's going on?
Probably feeling melancholy.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Did you lose a
probably
gig or something?
Melancholy. Yeah.
What, I don't know.
It was around that time that I bought my farm outside of Windsor, and I spent a lot of time there by myself.
Really?
So I probably had this on repeat. But the,
no,
the thing
no
that I associate
way.
This song with mostly is Love Actually.
Oh, that movie?
Because wasn't this the song that they rewrote to be the Christmas song? They rewrote it as a terrible...
The only thing I know
song.
The only thing I know about that movie is that R. Kells did a video of on it, and it was funny. I never saw that movie.
I feel it in my fingers, I feel it in my bones. Maybe that's a different song, is it?
Yeah, that's the feel it in my finger. But it could have been Take That that recorded it. That's an old 60s jam.
Right, no, that's Wet, Wet, Wet.
I got them confused for a second. Gotcha. Yeah.
Because they're kind of similar jams, aren't they?
They definitely are, yeah. Same ballpark. Same sappiness. Same...
I feel it in my fingers. I feel it in my toes. Love is all around me, and so the feeling grows.
Yeah, same sugary caloric intake to the amount of, like, a really strong fudge.
I know, but I don't mind
you,
that.
You can only have a little bit, though, and then you're going to get sick, bud.
I have a sweet tooth. I have a high tolerance for sugar.
Oh, yeah? But doesn't matter. You can have 3 chunks of fudge, 4, but eventually it's going to make you sick. There's not like a Homer Simpson button where you just can't stop. Like, eventually you're going to start feeling it. You're going to get a gut ache. Your head's going to start ringing.
That's okay.
You know what I mean? If you OD it on sugar.
I have another song that's sort of in that realm. From the same year, 1995, because it's our 95 jams. Hey, Jer, what were you doing?
Okay, what was I doing? Let's see.
Any idea yet?
Still trying to pick it up. It's a little bit hard to hear.
Yeah.
I don't need...
It's the poor man's... poor man's Boys to Men. They're called All for One. And the song is I Can Love You Like That. See if I can get to the chorus.
I remember that.
Here it comes. Yeah.
Well, I remember this now. Yeah. Gotcha.
That's,
it was hard to hear. But
you
I
know when
it.
The dudes that sing nice harmonies like that, they're tight and they're wearing like pinstriped suits, and maybe one guy has the jacket off and he has suspenders and he has his sleeves rolled up, and another guy has the jacket buttoned, and a third guy has the jacket open, and a fourth guy's holding the jacket over his shoulder. So they dress the same and they're still part of a team, but they want you to know they each have their own personalities.
Yeah. So I don't know if I would be like listening to that jam, but like I might have heard it when... Perhaps when I was like, I know when I was, or say an A&R guy was driving me around in LA.
Yep.
And one time we played the Dragonfly, which was just a greasy little bar. And there was like a dance club on one side and the club on where we were playing on the other. And the dance club was packed and there was nobody in the club. And we were like going on in 20 minutes. And it was Tom Maffei, I think, ended up being a VP at like, I don't know, like not Interscope, maybe. Anyway, Tom Maffei was the rep at the time. And he took me out to a joke shop earlier and I bought some stink bombs. like literally. I loved stink bombs, and it was like, again, nothing else to do on the road. Sober pranks and jokes are part of the deal, like blow up pens and shock stuff. And anyway, I got these stink bombs, and we're about to go on, and there's nobody there. And you know, it's our big showcase in LA. So I went over to the dance club and let off like five, you know, the little glass bottles. You crush them and then the stink. So I did like four of them over there, and the whole place cleared out and was packed.
No.
And our son, yeah. Ram jammed. And that Tom Maffei went on to say that was the best move he'd ever seen a band do to get people into a room. But I'm pretty proud of it.
How did that worked. Not make it in the book?
It's just there's lots of them that could be in the book too, but yeah. That's a good one.
Classic.
It's yeah, well, and again, you gotta sometimes yeah, they have to be triggered to remember the story, right? But that's a good one.
That's a really solid one. How important is like a showcase like that to a young band?
Well, it went from, because like the show was about to start, so like the press and the important people were going to be there, but there was no meat and potatoes in the room of bodies, right? And when I did it, it was packed, and that's all we needed was people there, and we felt confident enough as a band that people would be into it, and they were, so it was good. It was a great move. It ended up being really positive on all fronts for press and everything.
Boom. And you guys went on to do okay.
Yeah, we should bring out some stink bombs on our next tour, just in case. Huh?
Not a bad idea.
Play a little double rooms. We're just going to play the smaller room beside the big room, but on a night that's like crazy.
What is a stink bomb? What is the chemical compound?
I don't know, sulfur and probably some other stuff that stinks. And they put it in the little glass bottle thin enough to step on.
It smells like air.
You've never messed with them? It smells like really strong air. Like air beyond, like air bud.
Do you think in our house we giggle when we say the phrase Air Canada?
You definitely do, 100%.
No, we don't. You think we're
flying. Yeah, you do. Yeah, yes, when you say, well, guess what we're flying, girls? Air Canada.
We don't. We're not prudes.
Do they make the fart noise after?
No.
And then cover the mouth? The classic kid styles? Yeah, they do. I love it.
Let's take a break, bud. And then continue to dive into 95, because we have so many more jams.
Okay.
Be right back.
Fucking right, eh?
Hey, Jonathan.
Yeah?
What were you doing then?
Good jam.
Oh, yes.
Good jam, and a timely one, too.
Smooth as silk.
Let Jan Arden do the singing.
Here we go.
The whammy bar.
How do you cool your lips? Ooh, swank little harmonics. Droit. Hey, the little.
I know, harmonics and a whammy. It is
that,
very
Bill
tastefully
Dylan?
Produced, though.
Is that our boy Bill Dylan or Billy Bell there?
I like that her voice is front and center in this song, which it should be. I think I've been in a bit of a Jan wormhole. I think Living Under June is a great record. And I can't believe this song must have been on that record, was it?
Yes, that's the record. Which had a lot of hits.
She had a lot of hits on that record, and she is as gifted as a singer as she is as a songwriter, probably as she is as a comedian.
Yeah. Well, it's she connects on all levels when she emotes, right? Full on.
Yeah, well, it's that Donovan Woods thing. Like, you go to see a concert and it's a stand-up comedy special, and it's as good for both of those reasons. And I think what Jan does maybe better than most is the page turn between I'm going to be saucy and I'm going to be funny, and now I'm going to sing a thing that's going to rip your heart out.
Yeah.
I've been trying to. Told you I got a guitar effects pedal. I've been trying to pull together a cover of Could I Be Your Girl? And I think we should consider doing it at our live shows because it's a great song.
I'm in. Let's do it.
And it has, this is, the beat's good too. Doom ba da doom sh, doom doom sh. It has all that.
Can you guess who's on drums on this song?
Yeah, Jeff Porcaro.
No, this was I think this was unfortunately after Jeff Porcaro was passed.
Okay, so it wasn't
He's
him.
Big time American guy.
Really?
Huge. Huge session guy, yes. But also in one particular artist band for a very long time.
Huh.
Where you'd always like see, oh, there he is back there every time you saw that guy.
Okay, here's my guess. And okay. It's a little out there. Max Weinberg.
Not bad. Kenny Aronoff. You know Kenny Aronoff with John Mellencamp?
Oh, no way.
He always has the shades on and the shiny bald mask.
Those are some rim shots in that song, though, aren't they?
Doom, oh, yeah. Kenny Aronoff just crushes the drums. Like to the point where whenever he would sit in with the Late Night with Letterman band with Anton Fig. Remember, he was the drummer on Late Night. He... like when he sat in, apparently Kenny Aronoff would just crush his drums. Like they'd be all the tom heads would be all dimpled, and he'd have to change them all.
Really?
Yeah.
Does he wail that hard?
Just pounding everything like it's just owes it money.
So
just
tell
owes
me,
Kenny.
How does that happen?
You get paid by the PSI to the beats.
How does that happen with someone like Jan Arden, who's a Canadian artist? This was her breakout record. How does she get a heavyweight like that, like Ken Aronoff, to play drums on her song?
Well, I believe that was a big A&M, I think, label record. And so that was just a big push from the Stiets. So that's the big difference there. When you got, that was around the time, remember Elton John was talking about her?
Well, I thought Elton John was talking about Amanda Marshall.
Oh, he wasn't talking about Jan Arden, you're right.
Maybe
he should have been
was.
Talking about... He should have been talking about Jan. You're right, though.
He should have been talking about Jan. But I guess that's my question. Does someone at A&M Canada hear her demo and say, this is going to be huge, we should pull in some big muscle for this to give it that extra push? Like, what are the mechanics behind something like that?
I'm going to guess it was more like that label in America was like, here, we're going to do this and come down to L.A. or wherever, somewhere in America and crush it. With all these guys, like the Bob Fosters and the Dave Resnicks. And then I think, it was just a major label thing, right? I guess in Canada, like that, you could always sense that occasionally with some artists, if they were going to go for American radio, they would get all the American session guys or writers or whatever. To try and make that happen.
Well, I'm sure any session player, whether they'd heard of her or not, the second they heard her do some sneaky runs would be like, okay, she's the real thing.
For sure.
Because she does these effortless, quick little runs. And Could I Be Your Girl is in my head because I love the line, I am worthless sounds compared to all your perfect words. That's gorgeous.
Yeah, and she more than most artists, I'm sure she had her hand in every decision that was made and songwriting and everything else. Like she's definitely that record was her mark, I'd say, because I mean there was like three or four singles on that thing.
Yeah, it was nuts.
Like we haven't even mentioned that. What was the other jam on that song?
Living Under Jam is a banger, too.
Could I Be Your Girl? You're Gonna Rock.
Yeah. Was Good Mother on that record?
Good Mother's on there. That's the one. Remember, we've talked about that.
That's a good jam, too.
Remember, we did that.
I know we've done Jan Harden as one of the dancers at Popular Girl, which is loving tribute because you have to be a Canadian icon to get a stripper named after you. You notice there's no Bonathan Torrens in anything we've ever done.
Yeah, and like Joan Candy, like honestly, that's just...
It's the really, it's the classic. Greatest compliment you can have. But let's be real for a second. Jan Arden is the real deal and could do any of those things. Songwriter, singer, comedic actor, host. Like she really is the EGOT of Canada.
Yeah, for sure. What's so what's the next one here? What's your jam?
Okay, I want to play this one because I think, I know you were there, and I bet you'll have a lot to say about it, and I'm just curious to hear. Hey, Jer.
All right.
Where were you? Takes a minute to get going.
Where was I?
Can you hear it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I was, well, I guess I was not, when that came out, I was recording. Gonna kick in right here. We were writing and recording Clumsy, the Clumsy record. Or maybe finished the Naveed and in the studio writing.
That's were when you, it happened. Were you aware of Alanis Morissette circa Can't Do That on Television?
Yeah. Well, more of the pop music stuff.
So you were aware of her circa like too Always hot. Too Hot, Never Too Cold?
For sure.
Definitely. Like as someone watching video hits, or did you cross paths with her in the world of music?
Well, our bud, Terry Sawchuk, who was an engineer on some of the early OLP records, was writing with her, I guess, in that transition from pop to kind of whatever she became, like just herself, not kind of pop music, that's for sure. I mean, she was kind of like New Kids on the Block style, and, you know, that record was completely not that, so... Terry was writing songs with her, and she got in, I can't remember, the Scott something, her manager that she got a deal with, she started working with Glenn Ballard, who was a huge producer-songwriter, like Hold On by Wilson Phillips and Man in the Mirror by Michael Jackson.
Hold On, that was him?
Yeah, he had it's already a big, so they kind of had visions of this thing becoming something different and large. The label in America, everything was like huge. It was all massive, but she was at our first record release party at our first record before that. So that's when I first knew her. But Jagged Little Pill. So I knew the process was happening when we were, like I said, our first, Terry brought her to the Naveed launch party. So
what was your perception of her at that time? Were you like, who's the angry rock chick, or isn't that the Always Too Hot, Never Too Cold?
No, it's like,
person?
Hey, that's, it was just, there's Alanis, and she's just, I thought she was just trying to write more mainstream normal music that would fit, I don't know, like just not, she wasn't trying to write pop songs. So because Terry's like a from Espanola and loves singer songwriter, you know, your John Hyatts and that kind of stuff, you know, so it was, I was assuming it was going to be more straight up music, closer to Joni Mitchell than New Kids on the Block.
So all anyway. I can hear in my head right now is Alanis singing, "Someday somebody's gonna make you wanna turn around and say goodbye." Like a real angsty rock version of Hold On by Wilson Phillips.
Yeah, how come it sounds like the Chicken Lady, though?
I don't know, because I was trying to do that break that Alanis has in her voice. Glenn Ballard gave her every ounce of credit for that record and for the songs on it. And the way I sort of perceive it happening was obviously the Always Too Hot, Never Too Cold was kind of her being produced by somebody, but the You Ought to Know was her, right? That was the artist that she wanted to be.
Yeah, well, I mean, that for example, that song, It has like Flea from the Chili Peppers on it, or and Chad Smith or something. Like, it's all
you ought rock. To know.
Yeah, it's all like kind of designed to be very angst and punky by design of the guys playing the track. So, yeah, you could say there's an element of what they were trying to do made sense, but it's because her band was more of a rock band than a pop band.
There is the weirdest bass, like, little run that I've never heard before. We just played it right now. I don't know if you can hear it, but I'm going to play the song from the start. It's right off the very...
They just told him to just go off all over the song. He's just going ape the whole time, Flea.
The funniest moment is when it starts.
Yeah, it's like, can you overplay as much as possible? Sure.
Crazy. And then you guys suddenly found yourselves on a tour with her. I can't imagine the audience of screaming 11-year-old girls was your wheelhouse before that. Did you gain a lot of fans on that tour?
I'm sure. It was just a complete... It was like Beatlemania, except young female empowerment was kind of the vibe. And every single place was sold out beyond more than I've ever seen previous, all the Canadian arenas. And the crowds were so loud that I've never heard anything before or since. It was just from the sheer amount of young, strong girls going crazy. It was amazing. It was really fun, that tour. I had a good time. Frente opened up, that band Frente. They did the cover of that New Order song, Bizarre Love Triangle.
Cool.
And then Radiohead were the next act on that tour in the States, and they had just finished The Bends, which was an incredible record. Imagine that, watching those guys opening for Atlantis.
Crazy.
Yeah. Well, so, it's like the Van Halen tour that same year. Alice in Chains was on it as well. Yeah, they were the other band. And they were trying to get Jeff Buckley, but he was like... Or no, Page and Plant was trying to get Jeff Buckley, and he was like, no dice. I'm not doing it. I want to play Church Basements instead.
Really? Anyway, kind of like do on our tour.
Oh, yeah.
We don't want to play the big barns, bud.
No way. I hate that big, huge
lose
reverb.
Lose the intimacy, you know?
Yeah.
We don't want to collect the
big checks. Can't see you up there, so, right? Can't see you.
When something like that happens, so someone calls your label, or it's the same label, and someone calls your manager.
Like Robert Plant. Do Robert Plant. He literally heard Starseed in the limo and called his, like, record person and, like, literally called our manager from the car. So you could be Robert Plant, like, looking
You be
for
Robert
us.
Plant. I think you'd have a better Robert Plant.
Okay. Oh, what's this? Oh, that's a jam, isn't it? Let's call these boys. Hey, call her up right now. There's some... Hey, who's these boys? Come on out and tour with us. Let's do some shows. It was like that. Come on, mates. Get up on there.
How many that's shows did
John,
you do with them?
That's more John Bonham than Robert Plant. Robert Plant is more quaint and collected.
He's more sophisticated.
He is much more sophisticated. He would be like, oh, who's this? I love this.
He's a proper gentleman, right?
Yeah, he was. It's so weird, because when you think about it, it was 95, and I felt at the time that it was so long since Zeppelin had been together at that point, but it wasn't. It was just like, 20 years, which not even, 15, 18, 19 years, which is crazy. Or the same with Van Halen. Like, I was like, man, this Balance tour, it's like I felt that, like, it was, you know, so far after they were massive, but it was like 10 years after Jump, you know? So it's, when you're young, you think it's a long time. Like, the 70s seem like so long before in the 80s, but now, the 2000s, early 2000s, definitely don't feel like when I was a kid looking back at the 70s as 20 years ago. You know, it felt like...
Time's picking up steam, bud.
Well, it just starts whipping, and I think that mostly has to do with routine and doing similar things. I guess you got to try and mix the stuff up so you can, That's the only thing I can think. You learn something one, you remember most of that thing, but if you do the same thing, you're not going to remember it as much. So I guess the key is to keep doing different things so you feel like time's going by slower.
Agreed. So when something like that happens, like obviously Alanis was huge and selling out big rinks and it would behoove you to take that tour, but it's, yeah. And maybe the argument for it is it's a different audience and one that's not yours. So when opportunities like that came to you guys, did you discuss them all? Like pros and cons lists? Like how do you decide gigs you took and which you didn't?
Yeah, that to me, it was kind of because that record was so big and it kind of crossed all genres. So it was like it didn't matter if it was too poppy or too popular, you know what I mean, like too mainstream to do, because that's the only thing that our thing was, like at that point, at that time we had done Plant and Page and then Van Halen and we did our own tours and we kind of wanted to maintain our own identity. Yeah, but like when you hear about Alanis, it's just, it was something so different, and we knew that we would be playing in front of people that we would not normally have. And I'm sure, like, that's the, always, if you're a band and you're, because we were kind of fought tooth and nail against the Van Halen tour to do it, because we thought it was too rock and it was going to separate us from alternative press in America.
It's hard to believe now stupid that rock stuff that you and think alternative about. Were different things.
Well, at that point, alternative was, you know, Nirvana and Pearl Jam, and it was thriving. So to be playing with Van Halen was a little bit not cool in that regard. So,
well, in fact, you guys turned down dates with Bon Jovi in Europe, right?
Yeah, yes, for the same thing. And I was like, and it was for a lot of money, too. But it was, we felt that, I personally didn't think it was going to be a big deal with Bon Jovi in Europe, because they're so big over there that, and the way music fans are in Europe, they don't judge you, they don't categorize as much.
Yeah.
With styles, and in America and Canada, but mostly America at that time, it was really divisive. And if you do too many rock dates, then all of a sudden alternative radio doesn't touch you anymore. You become a rock band, you know, so that you're kissing away 30% of the radio market just by virtue of who you're touring with or even how you look, you know.
Hard to even believe. I bet you wish you had a second whack at those Bon Jovi dates now, bud.
Yeah, it was like we as a whole thought it would affect us maybe in Europe. But we did Avril Lavigne, open up for her. I mean, that's a completely different audience in Europe.
Where?
All over the place. Like from Italy to Scotland.
Would you do that in Canada?
No, it was just Europe. But we did it because it was huge venues and different people that had no clue who we were. And I figured Bon Jovi would be even better pickings, because it's like they might not know us, but they're rock fans. So I'm sure they would dig it.
Here's something that's never occurred to me before. Alanis was, like, circa You Ought to Know. It was not like the world had never seen a woman rock and roll singer before. But at that particular moment on the heels of pop everything, it was like, oh, wow, I haven't seen this in a while. Never occurred to me before that Avril Lavigne kind of did the same thing for kind of brat pop.
Totally. Well, right?
As an icon for 11-year-old girls that came out of nowhere and was doing something so different.
Avril was kind of a similar thing where it's like capitalizing on that individuality with a young person. And that, again, that was like a huge American label. I don't know what it was, Aquarius or what, but.
Yeah, she kind of like.
Conglomerate.
At a Blink 182 sass.
Well, yeah, it's like a power punk song, and the band that she had, they picked kind of could have walked off the set of a punk video, like off the Vans tour. you know. So, yeah.
Was that like opening for her?
Great, because it was a bunch of kids that had no clue. And again, Europe is different. As long as you have a lot of people, they just want to have a good time.
Yeah.
And back then, before the age of phones at the shows, I'm sure it was just even more of a connection. I've always found that there, I don't know, just in general, for some reason, European audiences weren't as concerned about themselves. We'd go to American festivals and say in Florida and half the crowd are, you know, swarming or slam dancing or something. And it's like, how can you listen to a song when you're, you know, jumping into somebody over and over? Like, what the hell is that? So it's really, that kind of gets old after a while when you're playing shows and you're like, man, half the crowd are just swirling around and body surfing or moshing. It's like, I get it and it's fun, but it just doesn't seem as connected as just people listening,
singing and along, enjoying. Or watching.
Yeah. I get it, but whatever, you know, I've been in a mosh pit and done it and it's kind of fun, but you really are, in a sense, kind of, it's like going swimming or something. Like you're doing something else while you're
right, you know, going swimming with a Walkman on, waterproof Walkman. Yeah. Alanis and Avril both went from 0 to 60 pretty quickly on a global scale.
Big time.
How did they? Because you kind of had some window into that. How did they each handle it? For dirt, but did they retreat or were they outgoing? Or
well, there's a big difference. I mean, Alanis was a lot older and already kind of had a start in the business, whereas Avril was very young and everybody was trying to get a piece of her, right?
Yeah.
So I'm sure she was dealing with, like, who do I trust here and, you know, how can I get through this with keeping my own more morals and what the compass that I see myself in together, you know? So it's two different things. I could, you know, Alanis had a pretty distinct and a pretty centered goal, and she was definitely owned it, and there was 100% confidence, where Avril, it was more obvious that she was very shy, and, you know, there was a difference, you know what I mean? Like, she's a kid. Kind of she was a young kid. Yeah. Well, yeah, and obviously, sometimes when you'd see it, it's like she's not ready for that kind of nonstop, the other stuff. Like, putting out a pop song and playing it is one thing, but, like, talking to press for 12 hours and getting shipped around and, you know, that part of it probably is impossible to deal with when you're really young. And you're blowing up and everything's going great. It's just, I can't imagine what that must be like, to be honest. Like, if it's just, you're just that one person, and at any time you're changing people around you all the time. When you're in a band, at least you have, like, a center of what things can change, but, like, at least you have the three or four people. But with that, when you're just a solo artist and you got a bodyguard out there, and that's kind of the only thing that's kind of connecting you, as opposed to, like, this is your band and this is the discussions and you make these decisions together, it's got to be hard.
Yeah, at least as a group you have someone who knows exactly what you're going through to compare notes with and strategize with.
Yeah, and who's done it? Like, who's really, outside of, like, Shirley Temple, from what I remember of being young and keeping it together when you're older, having fame and not getting completely bowled over by it like a wave.
Can't imagine.
Yeah. But, like, Shirley Temple apparently crushed it. Okay, what do we got?
Who did? Who Shirley, crushed it?
Shirley Temple. Like, she was a child star, but then she became, like, all these other amazing things. It's really cool.
Oh, yeah, there are very few that have handled it like that.
Yeah.
I would submit Taylor Swift to that conversation, who has not really had any professional missteps.
Yeah.
Except she got involved, as Carol reminded me, in some Kim and Kanye dirt a couple years ago. But generally speaking, for a young woman to come up like that and not blow it, that's pretty crazy.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, there,
hey,
there
ready?
Are
believe it or not,
there. Yeah.
This was 95. Wait for it. Remember?
The Friends, the Rembrandts.
Yeah.
I can tell you one thing.
What's that now?
I've never seen a whole episode of Friends.
Really?
I bet you probably
have.
I bet you probably
have. Big Bang Theory?
No, I don't watch Big Bang Theory either. I watch Seinfeld. I don't watch Big Bang. I never watch Big Bang Theory.
I know, but Seinfeld and Friends were the power hour must-see TV on Thursday nights. How could you not stick around for Friends? It was such good writing.
It was?
Yes, it was very snappy. Friends was where...
I thought it was
bad. I can think of two Friends jokes right off the bat without even trying.
Really?
One is, character bursts in, says, guess what? Chandler, the sarcastic character, says, the fifth dentist caved and now they all recommend Trident. That's a great joke.
I don't even know what the hell the joke is, though. What's the joke?
Because you know how it's always 4 out of 5 dentists recommend Trident?
Oh my God, really?
That's a good
the joke?
Joke?
I don't
that's
know
a good
that
joke.
That's too reachy for me. Too much
how
work.
How about Ross is going to China? What are you going over there for? I don't know. I'm probably going to have some, do some work, have some Chinese food. Of course, over there, they just call it food. That's a good joke.
I hate that show, though, man. Can't do it. Sorry.
Why? How do you know you hate it if you've never watched it?
Because I've seen clips, and I'm like, I'm turning this off. I've seen that. I've seen probably like 3-minute clips, lots. I don't know, hundreds, because it's, again, it was... But I watched Seinfeld later at night styles. Like, I never was like to sit at home at 7:30 and watch sitcoms.
Seinfeld, for obvious reasons, was revolutionary. I think that Friends earned its place in the cultural oeuvre. I always related to that show more than Will and Grace. That was never really my thing.
Why do you think I did watch Big Bang Theory?
Because I remember it coming up before me saying, I think it's the worst show in history. And you're like, it's not that bad.
No. I think we said that about Everybody Loves Raymond.
Here's what I want to tell you. Before we go.
You don't like that, right?
No.
See, I like that show. That's what it was. I think that's
a great
show.
Here's what I'd like to tell you before we go.
What?
We've talked about Alanis and Avril. We talked about Jan Arden in our 95 special.
We talked about the blue guy.
I know, but here's who we didn't talk about. You ready? This was 95 too. Any guesses?
I'm sorry.
Shania Twain, Any Man of Mine.
Oh, I couldn't hear it really, but I know that song big time. Yeah, I know my Shania.
Did you ever meet Shania over the years?
Yeah. Not a lot, like a couple of hellos, that's all. Handshakes.
Just some Juno hellos?
Exactly, the Juno hallway hellos.
Wait till the record comes out next year, bud. We'll be doing some Juno hallway hellos.
We need some Juno hallway hellos. Okay, how about Juno hallway hellos? Jason Priestley's a classic Juno hallway hello for me.
That's a good one. I would say like Ronnie the Hawk Hawkins.
Oh, that'd be a great hallway. But I'm saying like real ones. I'm saying real hallway hellos that'll happen. Like a Nickelback bod maybe. Like one of those guys.
Yeah, or Colin James.
Colin James high in the hallway. A Barney Bentall high.
Yeah, I'd take a Barney high.
But that's the thing. It's not like that anymore at the Junos. You go now and it's like, who are all these people?
Like Dead Mouse? No, it's Dead Mouse.
Not even. No, it's like just like 50 kids that you're like, who? What?
By the way, Kant Eben...
A YouTuber?
Is playing the halftime show at the Grey Cup. Kant Eben.
Kant Eben?
Keith Urban.
Kant
Eben.
There's guaranteed there'll be some R. Kell's hellos hopefully in the hallway. I love that.
Yeah.
I'm
That's
just
good stuff.
the young pop music has me sitting in the weeds a little bit sometimes. Like when they go through like the MMVA hosts, or when they go through the list of people who are coming, I'm like, what? Who? Where?
I know.
Is that even a person?
I know. Brett Clover.
8926. Right? One of those? Like, it's like, what is that?
Yeah, but the two is the letter S.
Yeah. Is that a person, a dance troupe, a clothing brand?
Or the flu this year. Good job, bot.
Good job. Talk to you soon.